Thank you. I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic. And I have to thank my wife, as I do for a lot of things, for the interest in the traditions. She always had them too. And the one thing that always amazed me about the traditions is that it's completely opposite from the way we operate in life, you know. And so our first thought of how to handle anything is usually wrong. You know, it's we have to change our thinking to operate in the way that Alcoholics Anonymous does. But anyway, I'm really here to tell you a little bit about the fact that I drank a bit, you know, and some of it not well. But I've heard, as Kevin said, we tape, and we've heard hundreds and hundreds of speakers. And if I were a newcomer, or as I was before I finally surrendered, I would have said, there's no reason why I'm here. I'm not an alcoholic. I mean, these guys started drinking at 12. I didn't drink until I was 18. You know, I was a real piker. I was out of high school. And in fact, during those days, not everybody went to college, or not everybody aspired to go to college. And the reality is that you were an adult when you were 18, and they let you do adult things. I had family that loved me. I knew they loved me. I had no problem with it. They were a little strange. I was raised by a woman who was not born in the last century. She was born in the century before. So by the time she got a hold of me, she was a little older. Kind of like people say when they get to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, she was a little older. And she had some strange ideas. She was the first generation born in this country. Her father came to work on the Erie Canal, and they lived in Syracuse, New York. And so she thought the sun rose and set in me. I was just so wonderful. That was a little bad because I took that to heart. I really thought I was so wonderful. And there were a lot of people who may not have shared all that with me. But I felt good. I had no reason to feel bad. So I get to 19, 18. I've graduated high school. I'm not going on to college because I was a little bit of a smart kid. And a smart kid, I had this thing with one of my teachers in school. He said, "You will keep a notebook." I said, "I don't keep a notebook. I can't pay attention that way." He says, "You'll keep notes." I can't do that. I had an 89 average in the class, and I failed and did not graduate with my class because he came and he looked at the notebook. It turned out I thought he was wrong. And he was right. He was going to hold that for me. That was a thing that came up a few times in my life. There were things where I thought, you can't do that. And it turned out they might have been right. So I'm not 18, 19. It's a holiday season. It's either Christmas or New Year's. We're going to have this big party. We're adults now. We're going to be allowed to have alcohol at the party. And the grandparents were going to be away. And so it would be just us kids, you know. And I took a drink of alcohol. And boy, life changed. I just loved it. I became an expert on dating. And gave dating advice that evening. One of the problems is I had not dated throughout all of high school, but, you know, actual experience really isn't important. I knew the theory of it. And I gave a few other pieces of advice, too, and I learned to drink scotch early because somebody came in with a bottle of scotch and poured out a few fingers of it, and I decided to show off a bit. And I did. And one person didn't drink it. I poured them both together, drank the whole thing. I'm really told I had a wonderful time. I don't know a lot of it. We went to church that night. And that's why I know it was either Christmas or New Year's. We were going to midnight mass. And during the midnight mass, the priest came down off the altar and said that we had to leave. And what they meant was, get him out of here, because I think I was helping him say the mass. I was going to drive home, and there were some big kids that took the keys from me, thank God. And they drove me home, and it was my father's car. And I threw up in my father's car on the way home. And my father was a bartender. My mother worked in the restaurant business, so they knew all about a lot of things. And the kids got me home. The kid that was driving got out of the car. They took off. They let me kind of crawl up the steps. My father picked me up and said, "Have you been drinking?" And I learned one of the really important things in life. Two. If anybody with authority ever asks you how much you've been drinking, two. I've had a couple. I'm not sure that my father believed me because he'd been doing the bar business for a long time, but he carted me off to bed and let me sleep it off. And by the time I woke up in the morning, he had gone because he had to work the next day. And I'm sure that he saw the present I left him in the car. But he did not come back in and wake me up over it. And I learned another valuable drinking lesson. There's nothing so big you can't hide from it for a long time. I made sure I wasn't home at the same time he was for about 2 weeks. And I let it blow over. So my first experience with drinking was really excellent. However, none of that makes me an alcoholic. The real clue was that I went back to that house the next day, and some of the kids were still there, and some of the keg was still there, and some of the booze was still there, and they started telling me how funny it was, and I was the life of the party, and I didn't mind that they were laughing at me. It just didn't matter. I was the life of the party. And so I started drinking with them again. But I didn't catch on to that clue that maybe something was wrong after you've had that kind of night with those kind of problems. I didn't catch on that maybe drinking was not really a good thing. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, they talked about having a home group, and I really took to that because in my drinking from that point on, I had a home bar. Really important to have a home bar. It was the one I could go into. Drinking age was 21. I'm 18, 19. I have really aged well because I looked as old then as I do now. So it's not... I got served everywhere. And this home bar was really important to me. What I would do is I would walk in. And it was a place... a long bar, and they had a shelf up there with a piano and a piano player. And as soon as I walked in, you would hear the tinkling of the piano. And now the purple dust of twilight time steals across the meadow of my heart. The melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love was new and each kiss an inspiration. But that was long ago, and now my consolation is in the stardust of a song. And I'm able to look in the back of the mirror with the drink that he has up for me, and I swirl it around, and I make the little water circles come together, and I have a glint of sadness and a hint of mystery about me. And I know they're saying, this is the most interesting man in the world. Now, whether that's true or not, nobody's going to talk you out of drinking after that kind of thing. You know, it's just great. And so I went about, and I loved drinking. You know, when I hear people talking bad about drinking, It's like they're talking about an old girlfriend. You know, I really don't like to hear it. It's we might not have made it together, but she was okay. I loved all kinds of bars. This would make a wonderful bar. If you had a little sawdust on the floor, this is a great bar. I really liked this kind. I liked the kind where they had the music sheets and somebody would play and we'd all sing along. I liked the fancy places, you know, with all the glass around and all of the stuff. But I liked the places that really took care of me. I had one place that I would go, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, or 4 o'clock in the morning, I don't know, they would close the bar and sweep up for an hour and then open up again. And if I happened to be resting with my head perhaps on the bar at the time that they were cleaning, they'd clean around me. They didn't matter. And if I happened to go out into the parking lot, and I get in my car, and I was going to drive home, and I was able to get as far as turning the car on before falling asleep, they would come out, and they'd check on me every now and then, make sure I didn't asphyxiate myself. And they were really my friends, I thought, yeah. So it went on, and of course, stuff happens. You know, I got married. For those of you who are not from Jersey, you don't know that what you do for water is you go down the shore. That's a proper way to do it. You go down the shore. And I would go down the shore, and I get a place down there with 11 other guys. And we would go down, you know, we had shorter summers, so we would start about March and end about October. And when we went in March, we would go and make sure the beach wasn't cemented over. And as long as that was okay, then it was the rest of the time was in the bar. You know, and I went for weekends. Weekends wound up being like Thursday night to Tuesday, maybe. I took a lot of vacation in days. I had a great time with it. But as time went on, things changed. A couple of the guys started getting married, so I did. It was about like that, too. I mean, she wanted to get out of the house, so, you know, she had her own set of things. But, I asked, she said yes, and okay, everybody else is, we might as well. And we got married, and we shouldn't have. You know, which is really the thing for a lot of alcoholic marriages. You really shouldn't. She was an alcoholic, but I was, and I had been for a long time and had no idea that I was. We went along. We had a child, beautiful woman today who's she's got two kids of her own. They're 15 and 17. I'm sorry, 16 and 17, soon to be 18. Just got prom pictures. And I remember that it was like this, you know? She was the love of my life. My wife was not, and I was not the love of her life either, it turns out. So after a couple of years, she figured that she had wasted her youth and decided to go find it a bit. And she went on and she had, she lived a couple of different ways, and she ripped my child from me and tore my family apart. And at least that's a story I told in the bars, because they really got a lot of drinks from some of the barmaids. I could make lemonade out of lemons. You know, the bad things happened. At least I could get drinking out of it. And the drinking went on and on. I got invited to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. by an employee assistance counselor. I went to him to talk to him about this trouble I'm having with this woman who stole my family from me and ripped out my, you know, my child away from me and is poisoning her and so on and so forth. And he asked me some strange questions. He asked me how much I drank, and I told him two. I told him the right number. And then he started to describe himself as an alcoholic. And I didn't know why he wanted to do that. I didn't really care. But he did invite me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought that was a really dumb idea. All I could think is that's really dreary. Those are losers. You don't want to go there. However, I didn't like the idea that the employee assistance counselor might think that it could do me some good. I was really upset at that, and so I decided to go. And I went to the meeting, and at the meeting, I was sure they were going to say, "Oh, you're here much too early. You're not that bad yet. It's okay." And none of them said anything like that. They probably said a lot of the things that I've heard in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous since, because we tend to say the same things over and over again. But there is a part in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that talks about contempt prior to investigation. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, proof against all argument, and can never fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation, which is exactly what I had when I went to the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But since they didn't tell me that I didn't belong there, I took the book that he gave me home with me and I read it so I could go back to the employee assistance counselor and tell him why I was not alcoholic and did not need to go to these meetings. And it is a magic book. It really is a magic book. So much happens to depend upon your attitude as you read it. And with that contempt prior to investigation, I found the loopholes. I went back and told him that I didn't need to drink like they described in there. I was lonely, and the place you go for companionship in this country is bars. And if it was ice cream parlors, I'd be this wide. But thank you so much for helping me see what might happen. He didn't argue with me because he understood the principle, one of the principles in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We say we don't like to pronounce somebody an alcoholic. For anybody who's wondering, it's not because we can't tell. Has nothing to do with it. What it has to do with is, I can tell, but if you can't, you're not going to do anything about it. And he knew I wasn't going to do anything about it. He knew what I had to do. He knew I had to continue drinking. I had to get to a point where I would be open to listening. So then I started on Jim's program of recovery. Jim's program of recovery is kind of interesting. They were rigid in this AA thing. I heard him say no drinking. And my program didn't include no drinking. It included drinking till right before you got in trouble. So if you could stop one before slur, you would be in great shape. So I embarked on that program, and I did really well for 4, 5, sometimes 6 days a week. The little flaw in that is that most weeks have more than 4, 5, or 6 days. And after the fifth day or whatever it was, I'd be sitting on the edge of the bed and saying, how did that happen? What went wrong? It was always those guys or that bar or that whatever. And I would modify my program. And it would be like, I won't drive past that bar because I'm not going to pull in there. Or I'll go and I'll order a drink, but I'm not going to talk to anybody. And I would take a magazine or a technical journal, and I would hold it up in front of me so that I could have a couple of drinks and a sandwich for lunch and nobody talking to you. Because I found if I wound up talking to somebody, eventually they'd buy a beer or a drink. And if they bought, then I would have to buy. And if I had to buy, they had to buy. And, you know, eventually you get to buy everybody. Just keep going, you know. So that wasn't good. I also found out I had to leave the bar while the bartender was on the other side of the bar. Because if he came around, he would grab the glass and fill it. And my grandmother gave me great values. She instilled great values in me. She let me know that you should not waste. And if somebody put a drink in front of me, I had to drink that drink. Can't just throw that out. And so that didn't work well. And I built a pool on a house so that I would have a place where you could have those blow-off days. You know, drinking and swimming are probably really good together. Very safe. You know, and I got married again, and this went well for a little bit longer, but eventually it didn't again. And I went down the shore, a lot. I went down the shore one night to see a friend of mine. We were going to figure out why this marriage wasn't working and how we could fix it, or fix her, straighten her out. I didn't really want to fix the marriage. I wanted her to change. That's really what it was, you know. I love you. Will you change everything now? I didn't find him, but I wound up in the car outside of the bar that I thought I would find him in. And the seat was reclined, and I was there. Tie askew. I like to show. And I realized that I only stopped drinking that night because they had last call. No other reason. If they had continued, if I hadn't gotten tired, I would still be drinking that morning. And it frightened me a little bit. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous and decided to go to the experts. And my goal in going to the experts was I wanted to figure out what I had missed in Jim's program of recovery. There had to be some little twist, you know. This really comes to me today because I had a call tonight from a guy that I've seen for about 15 years. Kind of sponsored for a little while, and he called me again. He says he has a new sponsor, and his sponsor has him on a regimen, and he's going to call the sponsor every night, and he's going to call another alcoholic, and he's going to make a gratitude list every day. And, you know, that's the approach that I had to not drinking or to not getting into trouble. I wanted a magic formula that these three things will stop me from drinking. I still thought when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I had the ability to stop drinking once I started. 47 years old, and I thought I had the ability to stop drinking once I started. Never occurred to me that there could be anything wrong that would ensure I would drink once I started, or make it almost impossible to stop. Never occurred to me. So I came to a meeting. A couple of guys started talking to me. They started telling me about their drinking. And now I've had enough failure. I love failure. I think failure is wonderful for alcoholics. I think it's the greatest gift that an alcoholic can get. I wish anybody knew that you remember your failure for a long time, at least until you start doing the steps, because it may goad you to doing it. But in any case, they told me their story, and they introduced me to this idea of once you start drinking, there's something different about us that I, and in fact, tonight, if I were to go out tonight and have a drink, The first thing that's going to happen is I'm going to want another before I finish the first one. Then I'm going to want another, and I'm going to want another, and I'm going to want another. And that's alcoholism. That's different than drinking badly. I mean, I did a lot of badly drinking, too. But the real key to me to understanding my alcoholism is not what I did in the past, but sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, 2 weeks sober, whatever it was, and I realized I am going to drink again. I do not know when, but I will drink again. I don't want to. With everything in my body, I do not want to drink, but I'm going to. I do not have the ability to not drink. Totally different than I drink badly and screw up. I mean, I drink badly and screw up too, but that's, you know, just side effects. That has nothing to do with alcoholism necessarily. But they took me up north where I got sober. They have diners, and some of them are open 24 hours. And they took me to the diner before the meeting, and they took me to the diner after the meeting. I say they took me. I don't know. They said, we're going, and I just followed along. I'm not sure they took me, you know, but I was so enthralled with all that. I loved the fellowship. You know, at that first meeting 12 years before, I thought people were talking about crap that you never say anything about to anybody. And then 12 years later, when I'm in my second meeting or my third meeting or my fourth meeting, all of a sudden they're saying it. It's very attractive. The freedom is amazing to me. I didn't know it existed. So anyway, we go to the diner, and before we go to the diner after, and they're telling me about their lives, and they're telling me about their wives and husbands and their kids, and they're doing things that I find really strange. They are sometimes admitting to their children that they are, now this is difficult. You got to remember, this is a man saying this. It's really difficult. They said they were wrong. And I was amazed at that. I couldn't believe they would do that. You know, even if you're wrong, you don't say you're wrong. Come on. But they're doing all that. And they're free and easy about their lives. And as I said before, I love failure. I think failure is a great thing. Failure has a very short shelf life, though, because the heat gets off as time goes on. I'm about 3 weeks sober, 4 weeks sober. The heat's almost off. And I'm starting to think, maybe I'm overdoing this a little bit. I'm going to too many meetings. And, you know, I hear it today. Maybe I need balance. And so what I do is I go to the meeting that night, and there's a priest there. He's not at the meeting. He's the pastor of the parish, but he's done a lot of work with us. He's worked with migrant workers a long time, and he knows us pretty well. And I talk to him, and he says, well, why don't you go over to this chapel and pray? I said, okay, I'll do that. That's a good idea. So I go over to the chapel, 24-hour chapel he has there. I sit down, I'm going to pray, and I can't remember any. I mean, I know the Our Father, they say that, and they say the Serenity Prayer, but I can't remember any other. I mean, I hadn't in so long, I could not remember prayers. But I'm nice and stubborn, and I sit there, I'm going to do something until something happens, and I read some of the books, and I come across the prayer of St. Francis. I had not come across this in a meeting yet, but I came across it in a prayer book there. And because of the confusion, because of wanting to stay and wanting to leave at the same time, it's a bad place for new alcoholics, or for old alcoholics, for that matter. But being in that place, the thing struck me strangely. And I started thinking about my life, and I started thinking about those guys. And my life, depends on how you look at things. I had a lot of things going. I made some money. I had the house. I had a whole bunch of stuff. I had a divorce and a half, too, but, you know, a second was coming. The thing was, I got up in the morning. I knew lots of people, but I'd get up in the morning, and I'd be on guard all day long for who was going to take advantage of me, friend or foe. Didn't matter. They were living comfortably. And I knew it was because the concepts that were talked about in that prayer was the way they were trying to live. I could see the honesty in it. I could see what was going on. I knew their lives were better than my life. And I knew it was because they did the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it convinced me to give it a try. And boy, has the world changed. I would have never guessed what it would have been like. I went on and I had a lot of resentment against the divorce and a half. And it's amazing what a fourth step and a fifth step will do. Because I can still lie in a fourth step. But if you do a fifth step where you're willing to listen to what the other person's doing, saying to you, you'll begin to see things a little bit differently. And I did. I began to see what was going on. Life went on. I got custody of my 15-year-old daughter, an angry 15-year-old girl, at 4 months sober. Good thing I did the steps. Good for her, good for me, good, you know. Because I'm so glad that I did it early and I did it fast. And I know it wasn't as thorough as it could be, and I know you can do a better job. But, you know, this, the one thing they emphasized to me was this isn't a checklist of things to do. Fourth, you're done. Click. Fifth, you're done. It's a way to learn principles that you're going to live your life by. We talked last night about living a day at a time, and I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about the instructions for step 10. How it tells us to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear, ask God at once to remove them. Developing that relationship with a power greater than yourself that is the thing that you go to, you know, and how important it is to begin to live those principles, to live differently. That's what I saw in those guys. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to live differently. I'll talk just a few minutes. I won't go into a lot of other stuff because it's Karen's going to cut me off. But anyway, but I do want to talk about a few things. I had a divorce and a half. It became two divorces. I used to have the idea that marriage was 50-50. The trouble with that is that my 50 is always better than your 50 in my judgment. Yeah, and when are you going to get in doing your 50%? Now, I don't put it quite that way, but, you know, that's what's really happening, and that's what I found in that fourth and fifth step. Because I did the steps, and because I had the help with it of people that I was willing to let help me, I mean, my attitude started to change. My insights started to change. My relationships started to change. I met my wife in Alcoholics Anonymous. She did not 13th step me. I was already sober and paper trained and housebroken and whatever. But the thing that was totally different was I not only liked her, but I admired her. And I saw the way that she went through things that she had gone through, and I saw the way she acted with the people she sponsored and with the people in the meetings, and I just admired the way that she lived. And so as we got to know each other, we fell in love, we got married, And last year, we celebrated 25 years of marriage. That's all for Maria. That's not for me. And one of the things that I've learned, and our life has been magnificent. It has been really more than I ever could have hoped for. It has been just phenomenal. But one of the things that I've learned is that dreams that we have and things that we want are no good if it's just I want it. You know? We have done things that that I would have never set out to do. I never wanted to do the taping stuff. I mean, I worked with some people sometimes and helped out. But I was looking to retire. I had finally all the burnt money that I had done before, all the retirement stuff, I finally got to a place where I'm making a lot of money, and the company wanted to sell us. So I'm 64, I'm out of work, you know, and then I got another job, and these people, they wanted to pay me more money than I had ever had in my life. And at that point, they had allowed me to work from home 4 days a week. I had to come in one day and to continue a thing. And they offered me a ton of money, ton of money. And the temptation is to take it. Maria's working with Chuck and Loretta, who were doing the taping before us. And she really liked it. And I thought, well, you know, and it became a great thing to do. So we went ahead and did that. And, you know, we're not making any money at it. I mean, we're really not making any money at it. Trust me, it's not the money that they offered me. but we've gotten to see all these people and to stay a part of things. And as things happen in life, I've been able to be there. Maria had breast cancer in 2009, and I was able to go to all the treatments and all the chemos and all the everything and be a part of it. And I was able to see her go through that. Now, I'm not going to tell the rest of her story, but she's obviously going through something pretty big now. And that admiration has done nothing but grow. She is just, it is... It's heartbreaking that she has to go through it. It's heartbreaking, you know, I'd like to be able to take some of it. I'd love to be able to fix it, and I can't. There's nothing I can fix. But I still see her helping the girls that she works with. I still see her with us. She told me the other day... that I don't know why I'm feeling sorry for myself. Are you kidding me? Take a minute. Feel sorry. It's okay. You know, and you know, it's the kind of thing I'd like to be if and when I ever grow up. You know, it really is. My life is magnificent. The details of it have sometimes been bad. The details have been good. But I've had a life that I couldn't have imagined. I've had love. I've had respect. I've had friendships. I've had more than anybody could ever ask for. I want more. But it's been great. And it's all because of all of you. It's because of the people that showed me, by the way they lived, that this is a way of life. And this is more important than anything. Last thing I'll say is, I'm not anything special. I'm really not, and I know that, even though I'd like to think so. But they wrote it in a book, you know? And some guys helped me do it. That can happen for anybody. And anybody's life can be better than mine if you'll just dedicate yourself to it. Thank you.